Are you a podcaster? Better yet, are you an indie podcaster? Gone are the days where only the big podcasts receive sponsorships. Enter Podcorn, the easiest new way for brands and podcasters to connect. No matter how small your podcast, Podcorn is simplifying every aspect of podcast sponsorships. You can set your own rate and collaborate with brands directly, and there is no exclusivities. As an indie podcaster myself, I absolutely adore Podcorn. This episode you're listening to right now is even sponsored by Podcorn through the Podcorn website. They have an amazing marketplace to connect podcasters to awesome sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today and start browsing sponsorship opportunities. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. It was around 1:40 a.m. on the 28th of November 2001 when firefighters in Chester, South Carolina, were alerted to a fire in a home on Slick Rock Road. When they arrived on the scene, they initially believed that the home was empty. However, after extinguishing the flames, they found the bodies of 66-year-old Joe Pittman and his wife, 62-year-old Joy, in their bed on the second floor. They were informed by neighbours that the couple's 12-year-old grandson, Christopher Pittman, had been living with them for the past 3 weeks. However, Christopher was nowhere to be found. The couple's black Nissan Pathfinder was also missing from the drive. Around 8 hours after the discovery of the bodies, two off-duty firefighters, Roland Pennington and Terry Robinson, were deer hunting off Smoke Ridge Road in rural Cherokee County when they heard a nearby noise. As they moved towards the noise, they heard a car door slam and a shot being fired. Moments later, Christopher came running towards them. He had a gun in his hand and said that he had been abducted by a black man who he described as being around 40 years old. He said that he had fired the shot, attempting to kill the man who had allegedly abducted him, but said that he vanished into the woods. Nearby, the firefighters found the Pittman's missing black Nissan Pathfinder stuck in the mud and a shotgun.
In these woods this morning, a 12-year-old boy appeared saying he had been kidnapped by a man and taken away in his grandparents' truck.
The couple's missing SUV and the boy were both discovered some 40 miles away.
The firefighters led Christopher out of the woods, fearing for their own safety. When they reached the volunteer fire department, they called 911. Christopher was taken to Chester County Sheriff's Office, where he told officers that he had heard an intruder as he walked on the porch of his grandparents' home. He described the man as a black man, standing at around 6 feet 2 inches tall. According to Christopher, he managed to slip out of the house and hide as he heard gunfire. Christopher said that the intruder then set the house on fire before fleeing outside and coming face to face with Christopher. Christopher claimed that the man then kidnapped him and threatened to kill him if he ran.
He never to me showed no kind of emotion like somebody that would be kidnapped and brought here.
Two search teams were immediately dispatched to the scene along with a helicopter from the State Law Enforcement Division and sniffer dogs. With a potential murderer on the loose, nearby Corinth Elementary School and a daycare at Corinth Baptist Church were locked on while deputies were stationed outside. Christopher was subsequently charged as a juvenile with 2 counts of murder and 1 count of first-degree arson after police began to doubt his story. When they informed Christopher of their doubts, he finally confessed that he had fabricated the earlier story and that it was him who had murdered his grandparents. Chester County Sheriff Robbie Benson announced that they were still trying to determine the cause of the fire, but said that they believed that the fire had been set to conceal the murders of Joe and Joy. A cause of death had not yet been determined, but presumably they had been shot dead before the fire began. The bodies, which were severely burned, had been sent to Newbury County Memorial Hospital for an autopsy, which concluded that they had both been shot with Joe's shotgun, which he kept in a safe. Joe had been shot in the mouth, while Joy had been shot in the back of the head. Following the arrest, Chester County residents and investigators tried to make sense of the brutal murders. Why would such a young child commit such a barbaric crime against his own grandparents? According to their neighbours, the Pittmans were loving grandparents who took Christopher into their home during summers. They said that Christopher seemed like your average kid. He enjoyed hunting, fishing, and four-wheeling, just like the rest of the neighbourhood kids. Quite often, Joe could be seen teaching Christopher how to drive the Pathfinder. Quote, "It's got us real upset. We don't know how to accept things like that. They were good Christian people," end quote, said Helen Yardbur, one of the neighbours. To those looking in, Christopher seemed like your average kid.
He was extremely well-mannered and extremely shy. Those would be the two dominant characteristics of meeting Christopher for the first time. Christopher was funny, you know, he was gregarious. When he was comfortable, you really saw this fun-loving side of him, you know.
However, Christopher had recently told other neighborhood kids that while in Florida, he had run away from home for 2 days and had threatened to commit suicide. He claimed that he had been placed in a home for 6 days until his grandparents came and picked him up and brought him to their home. Quote, "When they found out he was beginning to have problems, they immediately volunteered to go down there and get him," end quote, recollected Chris Snellgrove, pastor at New Hope Methodist Church. Christopher was born in South Carolina to Hazel and Joe Jr. When Christopher was just 6 weeks old, Hazel abandoned the family, and over the following years, Christopher lived with Hazel's mother, his father Joe Jr. alone, and then his father and his second and then his third wife. However, Christopher mostly lived with his grandparents, Joe and Joy. Joe was a retired railroad engineer and Joy was a retired receptionist for their school district in Florida. They had been living in Chester for around 3 years, having moved from Florida. Christopher's grandparents were the only constant and reliable figures in his life, and he followed his grandfather around like a shadow and nuzzled under his shoulder in public without fear of embarrassment. Quote, "My mom and dad, his pop-pop and nana, were like parents to him. He worshipped the ground pop-pop walked on," end quote, said Joe Jr. Next, we will hear from Christopher's grandmother from his mother's side.
He's a very, very thoughtful child. He's a little boy that went out and picked wildflowers and put them on his sister's pillow when she was sick. Just a very caring, loving child.
The trouble for Christopher truly began when Joe and Joy retired and moved to South Carolina, leaving Christopher and his sister behind in Florida, living with Joe Jr. Shortly thereafter, Hazel made a reappearance in Christopher's life before abruptly cutting off contact with him once again. Christopher, who was only 12 years old, didn't know how to respond or react and became isolated and withdrawn. He threatened to commit suicide and was placed in a psychiatric hospital in October. Here, he was prescribed the antidepressant Paxil and told the doctors that his father was physically and emotionally abusive. He told them that Joe Jr. often whipped him with a belt and made him run down the street or do push-ups as punishment. On the 24th of October, Christopher's father flagged down a sheriff's deputy near his home in Sumter County, Florida. He told the officer that Christopher was missing. Before vanishing, Joe Jr. had grounded Christopher for a bad report card, and Christopher responded by running away from home. The day before, Christopher had asked his sister which way was north, and since the family lived nearby Interstate 75, police had speculated that Christopher was heading towards the highway and north to Chester, South Carolina, where his grandparents lived.
He ran away to Mom and Dad, Nana and Pop-Pop. He just wanted the security of Nana and Pop-Pop.
Sniffer dogs were called in to assist in the search, and right enough, they directed police to the interstate, but there was no sign of Christopher. They issued an alert for authorities to be on the lookout and shortly thereafter, Marion County Sheriff's deputies found Christopher at an Arby's at County Road 484 and I-75. Joe and Joy convinced Joe Jr. that Christopher should come and live with them in South Carolina, where they enrolled him in a local school and brought him along to church with them. They also took him to another doctor, who switched his prescription from Paxil to Zoloft. According to Christopher, he was told to take 100 milligrams a day, but the following week, that dosage was upped to 200 milligrams a day. Just the day before the murders, Christopher got into a physical altercation while on the school bus. He choked an 8-year-old boy and pushed him so hard that he smacked his head off the window. School officials called Joe and asked him to come and pick him up and said that Christopher was suspended. Once back at home, Christopher's grandparents told him to write a letter of apology for his behaviour on the bus and threatened to send it back to Florida if he didn't improve his behaviour. Following Christopher's arrest, prosecutor Michael Hemlep announced that he was researching on whether he could ask for Christopher to be tried as an adult. The ultimate decision would be up to a family court judge. If found guilty as a juvenile, Christopher could have been released in as little as 9 years, but if tried as an adult, he could face life imprisonment. Quote, "As far as remorse, I didn't see any of it. I saw nothing," end quote, said Chester County Sheriff's Department Chief Deputy Bernie Cutlepper. Days after the shooting, New Hope Methodist Church dedicated their morning worship service to the memories of Joe and Joy. Pastor Chris Snellgrove prayed for answers, peace, and relief. Around 100 people crammed into the church while reporters milled around outside. The tragedy's impact on the small community was visible. Many churchgoers held back tears as they spoke about Joe and Joy and said that losing them felt like losing a member of their own family. Joy had been an active member in the church choir and a hospital volunteer, while Joe was known for his impromptu speeches during which he would encourage people to give themselves to the Lord. Quote, "She was more than a volunteer, she was our friend. She would always come up and put her arm around you and ask if there was anything she could do for you. She was a volunteer, but she worked in that lab like she was getting paid $1 million, end quote, said a woman who worked in the hospital where Joy volunteered. Christopher's father and the son of Joe and Joy, Joe Jr., told reporters that he couldn't understand what went wrong to cause Christopher to snap. Quote, "I want my son to find peace. I also want him to get help," end quote, he said. Shortly thereafter, Christopher appeared in court. Standing no more than 5 feet tall and weighing no more than 100 pounds, Christopher made his way to the table and sunk down in the leather chair. His lawyer, Yale Zamore, requested a mental evaluation, stating that his client had suffered from mental health problems and had been prescribed Zoloft and Paxil, which are used to treat depression and anxiety disorders. Sixth Circuit Family Court Judge Walter Brown agreed and ordered that Christopher undergo a mental evaluation to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. During a court hearing to determine whether Christopher should stand trial as an adult, prosecutors painted him as a troubled boy with no remorse. The prosecution claimed that Christopher had killed his grandparents because he was angry that they had reprimanded him earlier in the day for getting into a fight on the school bus. They said that Christopher was clearly of sound mind, and the fact that he fled the crime scene and blamed the murder on somebody else was evidence of this. His lawyer, however, argued that Christopher had been impaired by the antidepressants that he was taking. They also contended that Christopher would be susceptible to treatment and could be rehabilitated and should therefore be tried as a juvenile. According to prosecutor John Justice, the murder was cold-blooded and that alone was reason enough for him to be tried as an adult. During this court hearing, more information about the murder was revealed. Prosecution witnesses testified that Christopher and his grandfather had been watching a nature show on television together before heading to bed for the night. Once his grandparents were asleep, Christopher retrieved the shotgun from Joe's locked gun cabinet and entered their dark bedroom. He shot Joe once in the mouth and Joy once in the back of the head at close range. He then turned on the bedroom light and went into the bathroom to retrieve 3 candles. He placed the candles on the floor and used lighter fluid to spread the flames.
This is like it all just exploding. I mean, the little stain would just set me off. feel I was like a bomb that's ready to blow up.
South Carolina Department of Juvenile Justice Psychiatric Barbara Hart testified that Christopher described the murder of his grandparents very matter-of-factly. She said that Christopher showed some semblance of remorse, but said that he seemed more concerned on what his punishment may be. Quote, he never wept, end quote, she recollected. She testified that Christopher had been treated for depression, but said she found no evidence that he was psychotic during the crime. Christopher's defense attorney, Yale Zamore, said that Christopher had been taking antidepressants when the killing took place and suggested that it may have affected his judgment. Both the defense and the prosecution agreed that Christopher was mentally competent to stand trial. A Chester County grand jury subsequently indicted Christopher on 2 counts of murder and 1 count of arson, meaning that there was enough evidence for him to stand trial on both charges. A family court judge also ordered that the trial be moved from juvenile court to General Sessions Court, meaning that Christopher would be tried as an adult and could be facing 30 years to life imprisonment if found guilty. The trial was pushed back until June of 2004. According to prosecutor John Justice, the trial was postponed because Christopher's lawyer had requested more time because a doctor who was scheduled to testify for the defense wanted to conduct another psychological examination of Christopher. The doctor had initially said that Christopher was not criminally responsible for the murders, but he had begun to express doubts after observing an interview between Christopher and a doctor hired by the prosecution. As the prosecution and defense were preparing for the upcoming trial, Joe Jr. testified before a Food and Drugs Administration panel studying the effects of antidepressants on youngsters. The advisory panel was to help the FDA determine the best way to investigate whether antidepressants, classified as SSRIs, cause an increased risk of suicide in some children. Young patients and their parents came forward to speak about how the drug had affected them. Young patients and their parents had come forward to speak about how the drugs had affected them.
6 weeks after I was put on the drug, I swallowed a cup full of poisonous bathroom cleaner.
She hung herself with her shoelaces in the
girl's bathroom. My son died.
She hung herself in her bedroom. How many more people have to die before a warning gets issued?
Joe Jr. approached the panelists and read out a letter written by his son. Quote, Dear FDA, my name is Chris Pittman. I am now 14 years old. I would like to tell you what happened to me, what the medication did to me, and how I felt when I was taking Zoloft. Because of this medication, I took the lives of 2 people that I loved more than anything, my grandparents, end quote. Pfizer, that produced Zoloft, said that the drug was safe. Since it had been introduced to the market 13 years earlier, it had been distributed via 250 million prescriptions. Pfizer attorney Tim Hooper said that the company was aware of 12 previous instances where Zoloft was cited as a defense, but said that only one of those cases was successful. The previous April, a jury in Santa Cruz acquitted a man of attempted murder after he beat his friend and blamed it on Zoloft. June came and went and the trial was postponed once again. The prosecutor, John Justice, had been sent to hospital for a heart-related illness, and while here, his doctor ordered him to avoid stressful situations. After he was discharged from hospital, he decided to refrain from all trial work in the immediate future, including the Christopher Pittman trial. It was announced that Richland County prosecutor Barney Geis would be taking over the case. The change in prosecutors further clouded trial scheduling because Geis would need more time to prepare. Then the following month, Christopher's public defender, Yale Zamore, removed himself from the case during a hearing at the Waterboro County Courthouse. However, even with Zamore stepping down, Christopher's other attorneys said that they would be ready for trial by late October or early November. His new lead attorney was Henry Mims, who was aided by Andy Vickery and Karen Menzies, both of whom specialised in antidepressant cases against drug companies. Pandia Health is helping women all across the United States take control of their reproductive health. Pandia Health, which is the only woman-founded, woman-led, doctor-founded and led company in birth control delivery, is on a mission to make women's lives easier by bringing our birth control directly to our doors. skip the monthly trip to the pharmacy, and never fear running out of birth control again with Pandia. If you have an active prescription and insurance to cover medications, Pandia Health will send your birth control out for free, along with some amazing goodies, such as Hi-Chew, chocolate, tea, and more. If you need a doctor consultation to change pills or birth control methods, or just don't have an active prescription, for just $28 a year, you can have access to Pandia Health's doctors, saving you a trip to the pharmacy. Enter promo code MORBIDOLOGY for $5 off a doctor's consultation if needed. Pandia Health is about care, conscience, and confidentiality, and I'm so pleased that they've sponsored this episode. So head on over to pandiahealth.com. That is PandiaHealth.com and sign up today. The link is in the description. By this point in the investigation, Pfizer had given documentation to the prosecution but had refused to share it with the defense. The defense argued that the documents could help their case and prove that Zoloft sparked a psychotic reaction that led to the murders. In a move that the defense called a positive step in the right direction, prosecutor Barney Geiss said that he would be asking Pfizer to hand over the documents. The issue of children and antidepressants began to feature heavily in national and international news, and there had been a growing concern over the safety and efficiency of antidepressants prescribed to children. Drug companies are always eager to publicize any positive results of their trials, but they have an ethical obligation to report all of their findings, and the recent revelation that Pfizer didn't want to hand over information that could help Christopher's defense suggested that they wanted to hide results that were not what they had hoped for. In August, the FDA released a review that confirmed a link between suicidal thoughts and antidepressants, and showed that children taking the drugs were nearly twice as likely to have suicidal thoughts or behavior as those taking sugar pills. The review showed that 2 to 3 children out of 100 given the antidepressants could think about or attempt suicide. Following the review, an expert panel requested by a 2-to-1 margin that the FDA place black box warnings on labels for antidepressants that warn that children and teens on antidepressants may develop suicidal tendencies. Because of this review, antidepressants now come with a black box warning. They are the government's strongest safety alert, and it's just one step below a ban. One of Christopher's attorneys, Andy Vickery, attended the review and stated, quote, "The casualty of violent behavior has now been established by the FDA. In order to discourage off-label use, they're going to put a black box warning on Zoloft. Christopher Pittman got Zoloft off-label. If they had acted earlier, he never would have gotten that drug," end quote.
When someone takes a medication under a doctor's advice, they don't expect to become intoxicated to the point that they're out of their minds. He's a kid. He was 5'2", 96 pounds at the time of this. He's a kid.
Joe Jr. agreed, stating that if the black box warnings were on the antidepressants in the first place, there was no way he would have let his son take them. In December, it was announced that the trial would be moving to Charleston out of fear that finding an impartial jury would be difficult, if not impossible. Christopher subsequently requested to be released from jail to stay with his grandmother in Florida before the trial, which was scheduled for 6 weeks later. Judge Daniel Piper denied his request to be released, but said that he could be released if he posts a $175,000 bond and stays in the state. Christopher's lawyer, Henry Mims, said that the order was effectively a denial of bond because Christopher had no family in South Carolina. Prosecutor John Medder said that he was pleased with the decision, stating that Christopher was a dangerous individual. He cited 38 disciplinary violations since Christopher's incarceration, including cursing and using threatening and racial language against staff. He also reported that on 3 occasions, staff found homemade weapons on Christopher. Quote, "His only guardians in South Carolina are dead. He killed them. Joe and Joy Pittman are celebrating Christmas in heaven. They don't have any more Christmases," end quote, he said. The trial began on the 31st of January 2005, and the centerpiece of Christopher's defense was not that Christopher didn't commit the murders, but that he had an adverse reaction to antidepressants, which caused him to turn violent. In opening statements, Christopher's attorney, Andy Vickery, described his client as a shy and decent boy who was led to kill by Zoloft. Quote, "This is a case about one drug that has taken three lives. When you hear the case, you will have the power and opportunity to give one back. A shy, decent boy was acting under the influence of a mind-altering drug," end quote. He asked the jury to see Christopher before he began taking the antidepressants. Pictures flashed across a projection screen showing Christopher and his grandparents together and happy. Christopher and Joe on the couch together watching TV, and Christopher and Joy smiling at a church function. From the defense table, Christopher looked on and wiped away a tear from his eye. According to Vickery, the antidepressants became toxic in Christopher's system and caused him to hear voices encouraging him to kill. The antidepressants, according to Vickery, took away Christopher's ability to distinguish right from wrong.
Something flipped the safety switch off. The inhibition that keeps us from doing violent things, that something flipped. Nothing else makes any sense. He's had a tough life, but he's a good kid, and he never hurt man nor beast until he took that drug. The theory of our case is that a powerful mind-altering drug was given to a kid that shouldn't have got it in the first place, and it triggered very violent behavior. It doesn't affect the majority. No one has ever said that it did. But if you happen to be in that small, vulnerable subpopulation, then you've drawn what we in Texas call the black bean, which means you're the unlucky one.
Prosecutor Barney Geis countered this by stating that Christopher had shot his grandparents because they had disciplined him for fighting on the school bus. According to the prosecution, Christopher lay in bed that night, plotting their deaths, and then attempted to conceal the evidence by burning their bodies.
As he lay in their bed, someone armed themselves with a .410 shotgun, shot Joe Pittman in the mouth. And that same person took that .410 shotgun and fired, killing Joy Pittman. That person who did all those things is none other than their grandson, Christopher Pittman.
Prosecutor Barney Geis argued that the fact that Christopher set the house on fire and then fled in his grandparents' car was evidence that he knew what he was doing and that he knew that it was wrong. He told the jury that they must keep their focus. Quote, "This is not a case about Zoloft. This is not a case about Pfizer. This is a case about Christopher Pittman," end quote, he said.
And I know this sounds harsh about a 12-year-old. Chris Pittman is a murderer. I mean, it's as vicious a case as you can see.
One of the first witnesses to testify at trial was Andrew Martin, the assistant chief of the Westchester Volunteer Fire Department. As they had rushed to the scene, they could spot the orange flames glowing in the dark sky from 5 miles away. When Andrew reached the Pittman home on Slick Rock Road, he realized just how vicious the blaze was. The roof and porch were completely gone, and the woods and the nearby camper van were ablaze. He described how they extinguished the blaze and began trying to salvage the homeowner's guns. By this point, the firefighters had no idea that Joe and Joy lay dead upstairs. Detective Lucinda McKellar also took to the stand to describe the moment when Christopher finally confessed to killing his grandparents. She recounted that he said, quote, "I just aimed at the bed. I shot 4 times. I'm not sorry. They deserved it," end quote.
I explained to him then that sometimes kids have a hard time saying my name, so it was okay if he called me Lucy. He was cool and calm, and I was very, very impressed with him. My God, this is a 12-year-old, and you don't want to believe it, but that's what he was telling us. This was a very meticulous crime. He was smart enough to do it at 12. I think it was very cold that he walks up and he's close enough to Granddad to shoot him in the mouth to where his teeth are broken and the pellets remain in his head.
She told the courtroom that during the interview, Christopher had told her that he was on Zoloft, and she confessed that she had heard of the drug but didn't know what it was for. Defense Vickery questioned, quote, "Did you not think to find out before you asked a 12-year-old boy to waive his constitutional rights?" End quote. No, replied McKellar. Dr. Eric Newman, Christopher's doctor, also took to the stand. He told the courtroom how when he came to the doctor with Joy, she told him that Christopher had spent 6 days at a behavioural centre in Florida where he was prescribed Paxil. He said how Joy had wanted Christopher to remain on Paxil, but he said that he had none on hand, so instead gave him a single packet of Zoloft. 3 weeks into the treatment, Dr. Newman believed that the Zoloft was working. Christopher had gained weight and had more energy. He hadn't been thinking about suicide and didn't appear to be agitated. He told the courtroom how he considered taking Christopher off Zoloft, but said that a psychiatric test indicated that he was still a little bit depressed, so instead he provided 6 more weeks of pills and told Christopher to be taking the same dose, 1 50-milligram pill per day, not 200 milligrams like Christopher had claimed he was taking. Before prescribing Christopher Zoloft, the doctor had not consulted his earlier doctor or requested his medical records. He also didn't inform Joy that the US Food and Drug Administration had not approved the use of Zoloft to treat children with depression. Former Chester Middle School Vice Principal John Rogers was called as a witness. He described how concerned Joe and Joy were about Christopher. He said that when he called them to the school following the bus incident, Joe cried in his office and said that they had been trying to get their grandson help. He asked the principal to pray for them. As Rogers testified, Christopher began to shake before reaching for a tissue and weeping. It was one of the only times during the trial that Christopher showed any semblance of emotion. Dr. David Haley, a psychiatrist from Britain, was called as a defense witness. During his testimony, he relayed his belief that Zoloft had caused Christopher to murder his grandparents. Quote, I think there is a very strong case to say the drug has caused a problem. I'm saying at the time of this murder, he did not have the capacity to know right from wrong, end quote. In an uncommon move, Christopher's defense lawyers called a prosecution psychiatrist to talk about the side effects of Zoloft. However, his testimony soon enough turned against them. Dr. James Ballinger testified that some antidepressants, such as Zoloft, can cause people to become manic. He described how some people can experience mood changes, irritability, and difficulty controlling impulses. Some can even turn violent. However, when Dr. Ballinger was questioned by the prosecution, he said that after interviewing Christopher twice, he came to the conclusion that Christopher knew exactly what he was doing when he killed his grandparents. Quote, I don't think there is any evidence that's credible that he was manic. This was planned out and executed terribly well, end quote, he said.
There was no evidence that he wasn't thinking correctly. There was lots of evidence that he knew what he had done was wrong.
According to Dr. Ballinger, manic episodes last weeks, not hours or minutes, and less than 12 hours after the murders, Christopher was calm and even slept, which is behavior completely opposite to mania. Quote, a manic wouldn't feel the need for an alibi, end quote. Dr. Ballinger also told the courtroom that he believed that Christopher was simply a troubled kid who had problems with authority. Other psychiatrists had noted instances of behaviour before and after the murders. Back in Florida, Christopher had attacked his sister with a baseball bat and then had been bragging about killing his grandparents while in a mental evaluation centre following his arrest. 2 days after Joe and Joy's murders, their daughter, Melinda Pittman Rector, went to Chester Court to see Christopher. When she took the stand during the trial, she described how she didn't even recognize her nephew until he was pointed out to her. She told the courtroom that Christopher, who was usually smiling and expressive, seemed completely devoid of emotion and even robotic. Quote, his eyes were very, very dark. There was no life in them, end quote, she said. Christopher's sister, Danielle Pittman, testified that despite his mother's abandonment and his father's strict discipline, Christopher had been a happy child. He was extremely close to her and their grandfather, Joe. She described how during Thanksgiving weekend before the murders, Christopher appeared to be restless. He was talking fast and constantly fidgeting.
Started 7 or 8 sentences and never finished them. It's like his mind was moving faster than he could talk. He just acted like a crazy man.
He had also told his aunt that the medication felt like fire burning under his skin. quote, "He was completely different from anything I'd ever seen in my life. He was just crazy," end quote, his sister recalled.
He says, "Aunt Mandy, I don't like taking them because I feel like my skin is crawling and then I'm just on fire. It's like a fire burning I can't put out." And he's describing this to me. And I'm just kind of going, that's weird.
According to Chris Snellgrove, pastor at New Hope Methodist Church, he too had noticed a change in Christopher.
This withdrawn person who wouldn't look at me in the eyes. I would characterize his behavior in church as just sort of, I guess, fidgety. Christopher was kicking the back of the piano bench while the pianist was trying to play.
South Carolina State child psychiatrist Lynette Atkins agreed that Christopher's behavior was evidence that he was manic. She said that his inability to sleep and concentrate were indicators that the Paxil and Zoloft were making him unable to control his urges. She relayed her belief to the courtroom that Christopher's behavior after the murders, stealing two guns from the home and blaming the murders on someone else, was evidence that he was manic. Quote, "He did not have the capacity to form criminal intent to kill his grandparents. He did not know right from wrong," end quote, she testified. Both Melinda and Danielle echoed this theory, and Melinda even announced that she had forgiven her nephew for murdering her parents. Just before the defense went to rest their case, Juvenile Detention Center guard Laura Ann Bradley took to the stand. She described how when Christopher first came to the detention center, he was unruly. However, now that he wasn't taking antidepressants, she described him as almost an angel. She said that in the early days, he shouted profanities, racial slurs, and sexual comments at the guards and inmates. She said that he had often got into fights and was found with contraband, including shanks. Over time, she said, his behavior had improved. However, this was something that was countered by Stephen Snyder, a former 400-pound prison guard, who testified that Christopher had threatened to stab him in the stomach and eye before raping him and telling him, quote, "I've done it before and I'll do it again," end quote. According to guard supervisor Clinton Grant Jr., Christopher had even been reprimanded just the week before his trial. Quote, "Right up to the end, Christopher Pittman did not want to take responsibility for his actions," end quote, he said. Another person to testify about Christopher's behavior was Dr. Richard Capith, a doctor at Lifestream Behavioral Center in Florida.
Do you have an opinion as to whether Christopher Pittman was involuntarily intoxicated by Zoloft?
Yes, I do. I believe he was. I believe he did not have the ability to form criminal intent on that date due to intoxication with Zoloft.
Nurses at the center said that Christopher was a polite, calm child who played well with other children. However, after being prescribed Paxil, they noticed his behavior completely change. Instead of getting better, Christopher's anger grew and he was routinely being reprimanded for foul language, acting defiant and throwing things. Dr. Caput said that Christopher's behavior was the key to understanding how uniquely sensitive Christopher was to antidepressants. He said that Zoloft had made him manic and psychotic, rendering him unable to distinguish between right and wrong. He also said that Christopher blaming somebody else is not evidence that he knew right from wrong. He said that young children use blame, but don't fully understand right from wrong. Throughout the trial, it was noticed that Christopher's father was nowhere to be seen. His maternal grandmother, aunt and sister, sat at the front row behind him all along with other members of the family and friends. Christopher's defense said that Joe Jr. had stopped visiting or calling around 6 weeks before the trial began. According to psychologist Julian Sharman, Christopher had hoped that during his trial, his mother and father would take to the stand and explain why they had treated him the way that they did.
As I've gotten older, you know, I've realize that, you know, he's made a lot of mistakes that, you know, I could forgive him for him. He didn't know how to discipline us. I mean, he did what he thought was right.
When the trial came to an end, it was now up to the jury to decide whether Christopher knew right from wrong when he pulled the trigger. The trial had painted a picture of a sad and troubled childhood, and led to people questioning whether it was that sad and troubled childhood that contributed to his depression and ultimately the murder of his grandparents.
There's no other rational explanation. This wasn't a bad kid. He hadn't been in trouble with school. He hadn't been in trouble with authorities. He was a good boy.
This trial is not about the 15-year-old in his body. It's about the 12-year-old right here. That's who the trial is about. We do not convict children for murder when they've been ambushed by chemicals that have destroyed their ability to reason.
I don't care how old he is. That is as malicious a killing, a murder, as you're ever going to find. That is how close Chris Pittman was to his grandfather, who had to been facing him, looking at his face, and he fired that shot into his mouth.
It took the jury just 6 hours to reach a verdict. They found Christopher Pittman guilty of murder, and he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. It was the minimum sentence he could have received, with the maximum being life. Two of the jurors said that they believed that Zuloff had played a part in Christopher's behavior, but not enough to cause him to commit murder. At the sentencing phase, Joe Jr. made a reappearance. He said that he avoided the trial because he was afraid he would be called to testify. Quote, "I was a single father and I did the best I could for my kids. I lost my mom and dad, and today I lost my son too," end quote, he said. The Pittman case and the surrounding controversy regarding antidepressants garnered national media attention. It was featured on the front of the New York Times and was featured on Good Morning America. It raised questions about the standard of care for treating children suffering from depression, especially those in unstable family situations. It also raised questions about how children are treated in the justice system. Why is society committed to preventing child abuse on one hand, but on the other hand, fostering it by sending children to adult prisons? In 2010, Christopher pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter, and his sentence was reduced to 25 years. A Yale University study published by the National Academy of Sciences found that while children are genetically predisposed to depression after a traumatic childhood, positive social supports can keep that depression trigger from being switched on. However, that scale can be tipped with that positive caregiver who will provide a protective factor. That positive social support for Christopher had always been his grandparents, especially his grandfather, who he absolutely worshipped. But then on that fateful afternoon, it all crumbled when Christopher was suspended from school and his fears of returning to Florida, combined with his antidepressants, may have triggered a violent mania. That, or he was just a bad kid who opposed authority. 48 Hours managed to sit down and interview Christopher, and we will play a few of those clips now.
These voices in my head just echoing to my head and keep getting louder and louder and louder.
And what were these voices say?
Kill.
How strong was that voice?
Strong enough so I did it.
Were you aware of what you had done? Did you know that your grandparents were dead at that point?
I thought it was all a dream. I finally got to the point where I haven't forgiven myself, but I kind of found peace with myself. And then this, the trial comes and then it all comes back. The hardest thing I have is with my family. I don't really have a problem with, being in jail. It's just being away from my family,
Your family?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that you've paid enough of a price?
That's a yes and no. Yes in a way, but no in a way too, because in a way I feel, that I should be in jail for the rest of my life. It was me, but it wasn't me.
Most children who kill their caregivers suffer from psychological problems stemming from drug abuse, psychosis, or abuse and neglect. But in saying this, murder is still an unusual and tragic outcome of a troubled childhood or a difficult life. Research has revealed that biological underpinnings of how abused and neglected children behave as adolescents and adults. If you're constantly pulling a child's security from underneath their feet, then it's going to impact them. However, results have shown that if help comes soon enough, then there can be ways to override a genetic predisposition for behavioural problems. Sadly for Joe and Joy Pittman, that help didn't come soon enough. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to give a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Shauna, Amber Wright, and Nicole Moon Snow. If you're interested in supporting the show in return for my undying love, exclusive episodes, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, and other goodies, then check Morbidology out on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the description. I'd also like to thank everybody who's left a positive rating or review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It truly does help the podcast grow, and I am forever grateful. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, True Crime Real Time. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
We were able to capture some fingerprints, but again, same as the DNA, we haven't been able to match that to anybody.
He's probably one of the biggest, considered open-hearted people that I knew. But, you know, honestly, he had an addiction too, right?
Just the writing, we can talk. There's a possibility here that there were childhood traumas.
We're trying to turn every stone to find evidence.
This is Genevieve Germain, host of True Crime Real Time. Join me on a bi-weekly dive into the lives of the missing and murdered, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. You'll never know who else you'll meet along the way.